And we're talking to
John Doolittle, and my birth date is October 30th, 1940.
And where were you born?
I was born in Jamestown, New York.
Mm-hmm. And did you go to high school in Jamestown?
No, I didn't. I went to high school at a place called Hamburg, New York, outside of Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. And what did your parents do in those days?
Well, my mom was a housekeeper, as women tended to be back in those days, and my dad was the executive and owner, part owner of an insulation distributing company.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd say you had a kind of urban background or
suburban, middle class background.
And there's another reason. I just started asking this earlier because of something Paul has asked me to do,
mm-hmm.
and that is, what religious affiliations did your family have?
My family was Protestant, mm-hmm. and not particularly religious. However, early in my life, we often went to Unitarian Church. I remember doing that, but I'm not a religious person myself.
And you went to college?
Went to college at Cornell.
At Cornell. And what did you study at Cornell as an undergrad?
Hotel administration.
Mm-hmm. So you were interested in the college experience to prepare you for a business career in business?
Yes, I was.
Mm-hmm. And did you go to graduate school ever?
Yes. I just finished graduate school, actually, about 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But not prior to the
experience overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And what led you into, how did you first find hear about IVS?
Very interesting story. I took the Peace Corps exam at Cornell and evidently filled out the wrong application. There evidently were two side-by-side applications at the place where the Peace Corps exam was being administered. And I sent the IVS application in and never heard from the Peace Corps. And I thought, well, I got dinged by the Peace Corps. And
that is a wonderful story. Yeah.
After I graduated from Cornell, I had this to kill for summer job working as a flight steward for Pan American Airlines for 3 years, traveling all over the world all summer long. And I decided to do that the summer after I graduated because I was slated to go into Officer's Candidate School in Newport in October. And in the meantime, IVS evidently had my file and became interested in me to become their business manager in Laos. And they wrote many letters to my home in Hamburg. I wasn't living there. My mother would stick these letters into a desk and, you know, thinking that I'd come home one day and I'd get them. She didn't forward them on. So I first learned of IVS, to answer your question. I came home midsummer. And I went through my mail, and I saw these, must have been three or four different letters saying, why won't you return, why won't you contact us? We were very interested in talking to you. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got interested in it. Ultimately, I saw that they were interested in me, and it was sort of a slam dunk, you can have a job in Laos if you want. And In the Officer's Candidate School, it was Navy, and what I would have been doing would have been running officers' clubs, but no guarantee that they'd be international. I was very interested at this point in international work, and obviously, if you're going to go to Laos, you're 100% guaranteed you're going to be international. So we did a lot of, we called our congressman, and, who my dad knew, and trying to figure out what IVS was. Was it a reputable organization and so forth? And they had terms like chief of party, which I wasn't familiar with at that point, and I didn't exactly know what they did and stuff, but obviously IVS turned out to be a very reputable organization. And I decided to give up the Navy opportunity and take the IVS opportunity as a volunteer.
Now, why were you in the ROTC program at Cornell?
I wasn't.
You weren't.
I wasn't. It was just that in that era, they came after us because we had this, we had the hotel and restaurant background, so we didn't have to be trained for that sort of thing. So all they had to do was put us through the officer's candidate 8 weeks or whatever it was, and we became second lieutenants. And
so you were thinking of that as a possible job opportunity?
Well, it was back in the days of the draft,
mm-hmm.
and you had to. You had to make up your mind. Did you want to go off and into the hotel industry and just take your chance with the draft, or take care of your military obligation immediately? I decided to take care of that obligation immediately through that avenue.
Right.
But the IVS, you got an occupational deferment with IVS, so I was deferring my ultimate responsibility with regard to the draft by doing that. So that I just decided I wanted to go overseas. That's truly why I did what I did.
And thank you for leading to my next question,
okay,
which is why were you interested in going overseas?
Well, I guess it came out of that Pan American Airlines experience. I'd been flying for 3 years around the world. Many of my trips were to Hong Kong. They were typical trip would start at Idlewild or JFK now, and go to London, lay over there. Go to the next day, you'd go to Istanbul and lay over for a couple of days in Istanbul, and you'd go on to Bangkok. And so I got to know Bangkok over the course of those 3 years, and then on to Hong Kong and then returning. So I knew Bangkok, and I just sort of loved the place, and I knew Laos was real close to Bangkok, and figured, well, it'd probably be the same. So I was that naive at that point.
Yes, but Bangkok must have been a very beautiful place.
Oh, though. It was, I mean, it's nothing like it is now. No. It's just a gorgeous place back in those days, yep.
I was just there, and it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It was like having hell with beautiful art and the most lovely people.
Oh, the people are just, the people, I guess, are the,
yes,
in Thailand are the, the national resource.
But when you were, so you read the letters in the desk.
Right.
And you said, oh, wait, this is it.
This is something different. Checked it out. In Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then got back in touch. As a matter of fact, I'm recalling now that it was the weekend that I went home to be inducted into the Navy that I saw this stuff.
Mm.
And so I first had to get a week's, so I could make up my mind, mm-hmm, I got a week's grace period before I went in there to sign up, and we did all this research over the course of a week, and then I went off on one more trip and came back and decided to do the IBS experience.
And they didn't have Harper's Ferry then, so you went to Washington, D.C.?
I went to Washington, yeah. I finished with Pan American about the end of October and went to...
October of 63?
Of 62.
62.
Yeah. And right about the same time went off directly to Washington. We had a very short orientation there then, maybe 2 days or 3 days, as I recall, and then straight off to Laos.
Mm-hmm. You went via Hong Kong?
No, Tokyo. Went to Tokyo, overnighted in Tokyo, and then on to Bangkok, overnighted in Bangkok, mm-hmm, and then up to Vientiane.
And what was your first impression when you got there?
Unbelievable place. It was... it was so bucolic, I guess you'd say, as a the national center or the national capital, just unbelievable. I landed on that perforated metal runway kind of thing at the airport, and driving in from the airport, the chief of party met me, drove through the city, and there was one street light in the whole place. I said to myself, what did I get myself into here? This is amazing. And it truly was.
And when you arrived, you knew your position was going to be?
My position was going to be business manager of the organization, the rural development arm of the organization.
And who was the chief of party?
Bob Ziegler.
Uh-huh.
Bob Ziegler was the chief of party.
And where did you stay?
There was a kind of a ranch style, it's more like a motel style series of buildings that was very close to the AID compound. Mm-hmm. And I had a room right there, the same place that Bob was. Bob had the big room, and we all had little kind of cubby hole rooms in that complex. It wasn't really a villa. It wasn't a compound and as K6, you probably heard about K6.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like K6. It was simply a...
But explain K6 just for the
Okay. K6 was a compound where all Americans or most Americans that were working for AID and many for IBS actually lived. And it was a,
remember why it was called K-6?
It was at kilometer six of, yeah, kilometer six from Vientiane, out one road.
Uh-huh. And how did you set to work? What did Bob kind of introduce you to? Well, that's a better question. Let's answer that question, and we'll talk about some language training if you had any.
Sure. Answer that question first. Yeah. Okay. IBS was funded 100% in Laos by AID, and they were working on an imprest fund basis. And this is my take on what happened. Over the course, Bob had been there for a couple of years or perhaps more, and over the course of the his tenure there, he had an initial funding of something like $1 million in currency, and he simply spent it and kept receipts and not really understanding the imprest nature of the intent, never really documented nor resubmitted those receipts to get the next drawdown on the overall funding. Mm-hmm. So when I arrived, I can't remember the exact number, but we were essentially out of money because he had boxes and boxes full of documentation. No accounting system. No systems at all. There was a guy there, you probably talked to him, Galen Berry, okay, who was running the office, administration types of things, but he was not a financial guy. Mm-hmm. And so he essentially Bob said, well, we're in trouble. What we need to do is we need to document all this stuff and do what's necessary, do what AID needs to get our funding back in shape. And night and day for a good 4 months, that's what I did. Very interesting stuff. It wasn't the kind of thing that needed a double entry accounting system or anything like that, but it needed a system. And there was no proscribed system by AID other than you had to have, everything had to be vouchered and resubmitted. So we set out to do that. We hired a Lao to work with me, who that was part of my job, so I could train him. And took about 4 months, as I recall, to get things back in shape. So we had our $1 million back, and it was a bit of a fight from time to time because some of the documentation was a little bit rough. A little 300 kip for a Samoa ride back on the back of a envelope kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But all in all, it got done, and I got bored with doing after it was done. I was bored with, wasn't much of a challenge after that.
Yeah, that's like saying after God created the world in 6 yeah, days, that's right. Okay, rested, and he got bored.
Yeah.
Yeah, Galen, I think, remembers when he arrived, there was like just those little pieces of paper.
Right.
And I spoke to him for 6 hours. And,
okay.
And he said it was like, what are we to do with all this paper? And so you found yourself, you've done your duty. Did you ever get any Lao language training?
I did, but with AID two or three years later. I did all of my, I think I was hired by AID because I could speak Lao by the time I finished my 2 years, however. I think it was, in large measure, that was why.
But did IBS provide you the training?
No. You just
picked it up, or did you get a tutor?
One of the things I did was I taught Buddhist monks English, so in the course of doing that in Vientiane. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got started, as I recall. And then I was working, you know, just in the course of working and being interested, you learn. I'm sure it was very much pidgin Lao, if you will, at that point. And when I went into my AID work, I was put into a group where nobody else had Lao experience, so I didn't really advance a long way in that training, except that I cleaned up my grammar and my sentence construction and things like that, and I understood things much better. But I still only got to what I think the Foreign Service Institute calls a level 2 when I finished that work at Arlington. Mm-hmm. For AID. But I probably came in to the course at a 1+. So, mm-hmm.
I'm just as interested in the USAID for obvious reasons,
okay,
actually, and some less so. But when you were in IBS after those four months of putting the financial structure,
uh-huh,
into place, and then you were bored, one of the things you did perhaps because you were bored, was begin teaching English to monks. How did that project
get started? It actually, I think this is the way it started. It actually started well before the 4 months was up. But it was, you know, the people all around me, I remember you've talked to or will talk to this guy, Wynn McKeithen, who was, that guy was amazing. I think he's living overseas, so you probably won't talk to him, but okay. He was an amazingly adept linguist. And he's just like me, but he can speak Lao like a Lao. And I'm saying to myself, why can't I do that? And so I was trying to find ways, and I think I initiated, and I think IVS, Bob Ziegler said, you know, you ought to try to find a way to learn how to speak this language. And of course, we had Petsong and other people in the office who would help us a little bit. There was no structure, though, in those days to language training, which I always thought was one of the big weaknesses of, well, at least my experience, that I didn't have some early on structure to put. I did struggle, but I did get there at the end of the day. So.
Mm-hmm. And so you were engaged in that.
Right. That was sort of like 2 days a week or something like that, or 3 days a week. And I think it was at noontime that I did it, so it was in the course of my day-to-day stuff that I did that with the monks.
Would you consider that an IVS project, or just something you did?
No, just something I did on my own.
Because I know the best man at my wedding was intelligence in Vietnam, and when his day ended, he went and he taught English. A lot of officers did that in Vietnam, just because they like Vietnam and
right.
they wanted to do
well,
something
give,
other
give
than
something
their
back.
Job.
Yeah.
And this is a silly question. What did you do the rest of the time? I'll get to that in a minute.
You mean the rest of the time over those 4 months?
After that first 4 months.
Well, this was sort of an interesting little interlude as well. For probably the next 8 months, or I'd say time flies, 6 to 8 months perhaps. There was a national hotel that had been built in Laos, in Vientiane, called the Lang San Hotel. Meaning,
could you spell that? Okay.
I think it's L-A-N... G-Z-A-N-E, Lang San, means 1,000 elephants. Mm-hmm. And it was it had just been built, or just was finishing being built. It was an enormous hotel from the standpoint of the meters of concrete poured, because it was one of these Russian, it was a Russian-trained architect, and it was one of these monolithic-looking things. It was a horrible design. And the... they had no plans for how they were going to actually implement the opening of this thing. So, you know, I'm down there and I'm looking around. I'm thinking, what can I do here? You catch the fever of community development. Or at least I'd caught the fever. I went over there to be business manager, but I didn't want to be a business manager once I got there because all the guys that were doing stuff were in the community development area. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying, what can I contribute? So, well, I have a hotel background, so I went and poked around that hotel a little bit. Then I got an idea that we could. Oh, then I found out that there was a planned opening in about, oh, I think it was about a year, but that all of the employees were going to be Vietnamese because the Lao don't like to serve and they didn't want to be subservient. And so this here you had a national hotel that would no Lao involved except probably the managing director or something like that. So I went to Ziegler and said, well, what do you think about a training program for the Lao in things like housekeeping and front desk and things like that which are positions that they could undertake. And he thought it was a pretty good idea, and although, you know, didn't think it'd ever happen, I don't think. But I went down to Bangkok. I think I took one of my leave weekends, and I went down to Bangkok, and I went to the most luxurious hotel in Bangkok at the time. I just walked in and said who I was, and it turns out that the lady that owned this is the Rama Hotel, which was at that time. I know it's not any longer, but at that time it was the pièce de résistance of hotels, probably around the world. It was an excellent hotel, and the lady that owned it had a son at Cornell. So bing, you know, ping, you hit. And the guy who was her number two man had a real desire to have somebody from Cornell around and on staff and so forth. It was a, it's sort of like the Harvard of in the hotel industry. Cornell is the best school. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot easier than I'd anticipated. I said, well, look, I can't come. They wanted to hire me. So I said, I can't come. I've got an obligation. But I said, maybe we could set up together a symbiotic relationship here. We bring Lau down here and train them on staff and then send them back up there. So we did. I went back and Bob thought, he says, he couldn't believe that I did it, I don't think. But he said, okay, go ahead. Try to get it going. Get the curriculum done. Get the, go down and work with the staff. So I went down to Bangkok for it was back and forth, as I say, Mark, I can't remember how long, but we set up a curriculum and we got some people trained in the front desk, housekeeping, and some of the banquet areas. That's where we were going to start because we thought we could have the most success in those areas. And it wasn't without a little bit of teeth pulling amongst the Thai to get them to do it, because they the idea of having Lau come down and become students of theirs, that was hard for some of them to grasp and to want to do, frankly. But we got it right to the point where we were going to go. Now we needed to go up and recruit the people from Laos to do this thing, and Walt Coward had taken over from Ziegler. Now at this point, there's been a changing of the guards, and a controller of AID had come by, and I'd seen him in Bangkok, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I told him what I was doing," and he said, "Well, that's interesting." So I kind of went back to Vientiane. The next thing I know, I have a call from Walt saying, "Get your butt back here. You're not supposed to be down there anymore." And the way it was, I don't know what the real deal was, but the way it was stated to me is this: you have a rural development contract here, and you're doing urban development. I said, "Yeah. So what?" And they said, "Well, you can't do it. Aid doesn't want you down there." So we scrapped it. It was about 4 months. I'd say about 8 months worth of endeavor. I had a great time in Bangkok. Obviously, Bangkok's a marvelous place. I was living at the hotel, and I was traveling back and forth to Vientiane as well, trying to get the thing going. At one point, the hotel manager had a heart attack, so I was kind of the titular head of the place for a couple of months. But ultimately, and then I was ticked off too. I remember you guys promised these people down here. They spent all this time, and we got some people in Vientiane depending upon us, and they just scrapped us. I almost was wanting to walk away. And I remember, I think I might have told Walt that I think I will walk. And then I got to thinking more about it. It's my first job out of college, and I quit my first job. It wasn't the right thing to do, so I went back. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm kind of, here I am. And so it was almost just about a year that I'd arrived, that I was back in Vientiane with nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a, there was a new business manager by this time, because they were clear that I didn't want to just do that kind of business management. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember who that was?
Oh, geez, I don't remember the fellow's name. I don't. Mm-hmm.
So what did you do then?
Then I was assigned, this was the most interesting part of my tour with IBS. I was assigned to PAXA. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I established, well, they were established, almost all of them were established, the one that I established, but I administered, managed, or facilitated and coordinated, whichever word you want to pick, the operation of three cooperatives. You might call them farmers cooperatives. They were truly consumer co-ops that had a little bit of a credit feature to them and a little bit of a credit feature, I think, is the only other thing you could say. and they were in very remote areas. And the idea was they were serving people who didn't use the keep as a currency. They were in a barter society, and now they had keep, and we needed to bring in things so that they'd have something to buy. And this was another one of these Rimpress kinds of things. You know, you bring in the goods, people pay for the goods, you take the money, and you go to Thailand and buy more stuff and bring it back, and so on. So these three facilities were, let me see if I can remember, Pak Song, Hue Sai, and Saravan. Three places, and there was a fourth that really never got. I was trying to think before you came where that fourth one was, but I can't really recall. But it really, while I was there, it never got off the ground. So that was, and so I did that for the better part of a year, and before I left and went back. That was so I was assigned to Paksay. There was a guy there that was sort of an older IBS guy, but I really didn't work for him. I worked for for John McQueen, who was the AID guy in Paksay.
Who was the older IBS guy?
The guy that just died, Oliver St. P, I think is his name. St. P, he's from Louisiana. Oliver St. P, yeah.
How do you spell that last name?
I would think STPEE, but I can't remember, frankly. I mean, it was a guy that I knew and saw every day. Didn't work for him, though, so I didn't write to him. I can't really spell his name.
So you were in Paksay for the second
year,
setting
right.
up these cooperatives, which actually didn't get off the ground before you left?
No, I'd say the setting up is the wrong word. Two and a half of them essentially had been set up, and the one in Saravan I set up or finished setting up. They were going concerns when I got there, but they were having a lot of they weren't being managed. They things weren't going well, so they wanted an expat down there to make sure that to make sure that money wasn't being stolen, that goods were getting to the people, and that all the logistical stuff that.
And let's see, what was your relationship with other IBSers during that time period?
We all lived in the same one great big house
in
Paksay. All lived together, ate together, played together, didn't really work together. I worked totally on my own. I was flying. I was using Air America resources a lot. I was flying. These places were really remote. I should say they were in Mountain Yard areas. They were in the Bolivan Plateau areas, and so getting stuff, and it was bad guy area to some degree. So getting the stuff to the co-ops was sometimes difficult. For instance, blankets. We used to fly blankets in. A lot of the stuff was ground transportation. We just take a chance and send it through. But blankets in the cold season we used to fly in, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but there was a lot of logistical coordination that I did, but it was all on my own. I'd just fly with a Air America pilot, fill the plane up with as much as we could get in there and go.
None of them look like Mel
Gibson. No. A couple of them are pretty stupid guys, I'll tell you. There, especially one guy that we had a situation where he was the first time in the southern region and heard about these waterfalls down to the southeast of where Paksay is, and wanted to go over and see him. And I told him not to do it, and we went over there and we got hit with a ground fire. The round went right through past my right leg, right up. Past his left or right ear, and I was never so ticked off in my life as just one of those incidents.
Yes, that's that joyriding your parents.
Yeah, for absolutely no reason to be there.
Right.
Yeah.
What was your? How would you describe? Putting aside entirely your career with USAID.
Yeah.
What was your relations with the USAID then, and its relation with IBS? as you saw it then?
I'd say that in my experience, not the hearsay experience, but in my experience, it was excellent. I had a great relationship with the, I got hired by those guys in a sense, and I think that sort of goes to my experience with them. They were doing good things, I thought, and I wasn't embroiled in the kind of at that time at least in the it was hard to understand that we were really supporting a war effort there. It was really, for us, it was community development. Everybody seemed to be trying to do the right thing, and it was a good relationship.
And when you were in IBS, because this is very typical, by the way, I'd like to elaborate what you just said so we understand how you felt that way. See, the problem is that for more political, more politicized period later, mm-hmm. a lot of IBSers were asking, how could I have been so naive that this wasn't part of a war effort? On the other hand, there were good reasons for being that naive then, because mm-hmm. there didn't seem any visible war effort. I mean, they didn't feel that.
That's true.
That was going on.
I try to think back to that year, 1964, and try to figure out why it was that things were so rosy then. And in large measure, I don't really think that the AID people were considering that their efforts were primarily war effort kinds of things. I'm sure there were some people there. I'm sure McQueen. I mean, people that were plugged into the AID and Vientiane and so forth, obviously, that you find out later that they knew what was happening. There are intelligence reports all the time. And many summits to figure out what we were going to do with community development and things like that. But it just seemed then as if digging and drilling wells and building schools and doing road work and really having some irrigation project going and things like that were really what it was all about, and somehow AID, this grand organization, is over here paying for all this, and it's wonderful, but how it contributed to a war effort was hard to. It wasn't until 65 that you started to get the sense that you're a pawn in a game. Mm-hmm. At least that was my experience.
That was your feeling. Did you ever meet Pop Buell?
Yeah, sure.
What did you think of Pop?
I only met him in passing. He was, when I was business manager, he was one of the guys on, that would come in the office, and...
Pop was still IBS then?
I think he was AID. I think he just would come in uh-huh. and say hello. And he was a legend in his own time, for sure. And you heard about his exploits, but he just seemed like another guy out there doing good work. I didn't bow down to him or anything like that. Mm-hmm. He was just a guy with a good reputation.
And he seemed to be a guy, this is the interesting thing, what was his reputation to you then, while you were in IBS?
He was somebody, because it sort of changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, he almost became known as an operative in a sense later on, but at that point he was just a guy who had made real headway in getting to know the people and worked worked at a local level, had tremendous communication with the male people and the headmen and just the rank and file. You saw pictures all over the place with it. So he was at that point in the IBS tour, he was just one of the really good success stories because he got so close to the people. It was later that that image was changed to some degree.
Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that because that's more of the when you were in USAID. Let's see. Were there any memorable foreigners that you met in Benching, people passing through? I just mentioned this. Tim Page, for example, eventually comes up to Laos and meets Gail and met him. And John Steinbeck made a visit. And just wonder whether that question flushes out anything.
And, no, I don't think so. I remember one time meeting I was out in Saravan, I think it was, the only American, or I thought the only Caucasian within 200 miles of this place, and I'm walking down a path, and all of here comes this Anglo-looking guy, and it's a German guy, and he doesn't speak any. One of the few Germans I've ever met that didn't really speak any English, and so we talked to each other in Lao, and it just seemed like a very funny situation, but he obviously wasn't a famous guy, so I don't remember. There are a lot of famous guys that I ran into in Vietnam, but. In Laos, I really never ran into him. Mm-hmm. No.
I, by the way, we're not in the business here. Isn't chalk up the famous people you met? It was more of wouldn't that might a spark. For example, I said, did you know anyone in Vung Tau? And the guy says, well, I met this guy John Paul Van for dinner. Hmm. So, well, that's interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
But,
okay.
Yeah. So, but anyway. Did you have any feelings as that second year came to an end when you were in Pak Say about what you do next?
Well, they told me, they being USAID people, Dr. Thomas, you probably heard, he was the USAID person in Vientiane responsible for community development, and it was in IVS's contract. He was the contract officer, I believe. He delegated that, but he was the ultimate contract officer.
Do you remember his first name?
Howard.
Howard. Oh, okay.
Had said, we'd really like you to think about coming back and working for us. We have this special program starting in Berkeley sometime next year. Would you be interested? Mm-hmm. So I said, I really didn't think of coming back with IBS for a second tour. When I think back to that, I think it's because I had a sort of an early-on offer from AID, and obviously the money was a whole lot different, and it looked as though the AID people and the IVS people essentially did the same things. I mean, so you know, why not make more money and do the same thing? Because I was enjoying my Pak Say experience immeasurably. I was so glad that instead of spending 2 years as a business manager, I learned about community. I couldn't even spell community development when I arrived there, I'm sure, and didn't know anything about the concepts of it. I think it was the overture of a position with AID that I was thinking about as I left. Okay. And I took a month going home. I went through the Australia and New Zealand and the South Sea Islands. And I knew that this program wasn't going to start until the first quarter of 65. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of, and I went, my mom had died while I was over with IBS, and I knew I needed to spend some time with my dad, and so I just decided I'd do that for a couple of months and just wait and see if I, it wasn't an offer at the point that I left because they hadn't got the funding for it yet, but it was a quasi-offer.
Mm-hmm. And then it firmed up?
It firmed up, well, yeah, with a lot of, it did firm up. I had a lot of trouble because of my draft board, but I ultimately...
Well, how did that happen?
I was accepted in the program. I was about to leave, and all of a sudden the draft board calls up and said that I was being drafted. And I said, I don't understand this. I'm going back over there. I'm working for AID.
And you did.
And then all of a sudden there was a big newspaper article about it in the Buffalo Evening News. Big expo. And where this information came from, nobody ever told me. Nobody ever found out. But all of a sudden, a day later, the deferment is reinstated, and I'm off.
What was the article about?
Me. I was around Buffalo. I was a or in Hamburg. I was fairly well known because of athletics,
uh-huh.
And so I had, you know, they got a hold of this story. And
what was the story?
Story was that it was. I remember. I've got it out in the garage someplace. Uh-huh. Will AID or the Army get Doolittle? something like that. I could find it and send it to you if you wanted to.
Oh, right.
And it was whether my dad was involved in getting this thing over. I have no idea because he was like that. He would do things and I wouldn't know about him. But I don't know how, because I did absolutely nothing. All I did was say, hey, I might. But in any event, I went into the program. I went back to Berkeley in early 65 for 4 months, and then I went back to Arlington for the summer and in the fall, and finally returned to Laos in 66, early 66. No, I don't.
Okay.
Just early 66.
Doesn't matter much. One last thing before we leave the newspaper article.
Mm-hmm.
You did two. You want to get that?
Yeah.
Let me just.
Get back at it. Here.
Get back at it. Yeah. About that, the newspaper article. You were in IBS for 2 years.
Right.
Wouldn't your draft board?
You'd think so. That was why
yeah.
It was all the mystery about it. You know, yeah, it was like. Somebody, I don't know what happened. I just have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it resolved itself somehow all of a sudden, about 4 or 5 days after the, as I recall, after this article was published.
Oh, that's great. So then you went to Berkeley. What was the program like in Berkeley?
It was interesting program. It was an area studies kind of a program.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what they called it. They were trying to familiarize this group of people that they decided was going to be, it was actually a group of potential community development advisors
mm-hmm.
in Laos and Thailand. So the two groups were together. Generally speaking, the Thai advisors were much older, and the Lao guys were young guys. And they'd come from Peace Corps, they'd come from Special Forces, they're from all over, different walks of life. And I would think I was the only IBSer in that particular. I was the only IBSer that was in that group. And the course was a lot of it was a potpourri of different things. For instance, we went up to Davis for a couple of weeks for rice, for agricultural stuff, particularly rice culture. We had a tea group session, which was a really interesting one. Where they took us off and put us through the psychological stuff for about 3 or 4 days, which was I'd never been exposed to that kind of thing before, and it certainly turned out to be real interesting.
Did it work, by the way? Did they have any mental problems with people in Laos?
They had a lot of issues between people. One guy that didn't even it would never talk. You know, never said anything. Thought of the whole thing was a bunch of hooey, and didn't want to. So personality traits really did come out, but nobody got washed out because of it. Just was real interesting to see how people reacted to you, and it did make you a more empathetic type of an individual. I think so. It had some value. The history of probably the sort of things that you teach were covered there. Fair amount of Buddhism was covered. So it was a as I say, a potpourri of different things. I think it was a grant that was given to Berkeley, and they tried to slap a program together at the last minute, kind of a deal.
Do you remember any of the instructors?
Mm-mm.
I mean, it's unlikely. But
yeah, I remember that there was this one lady who was she was an anthropologist that ran the thing. But you know, doctor, and she was, but I can't recall her name right now. If I do run, I'll get out my files.
If a name like Popkin, who else was there then?
I'll tell you somebody that was there. Mario Savio was there, and it was right in the middle of the
mm-hmm.
free speech movement.
Well, I was kind of hoping you'd mention that.
And yeah, and being an AID person on campus at the time, and when they found out about this, holy moly, it was interesting discussions, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And at this point in my life, I was a total proponent of the domino theory, and you know, I was a believer. I thought, I truly was a believer. I was a defender of the position that we had taken, and so the discussions were heated very often.
Who did you have discussions with?
Students.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just students that you get to know because you were essentially on campus as a student. You'd use the student union and go to events and things like that. So.
And you were about their age.
Yeah, I was. I was 1 year older or something like that. I was like a grad student. So.
Uh-huh.
And I'd had this, and they find out that you've been over there for 2 years. It was, you become a prime target to talk to.
Uh-huh. Well, what did people ask you?
Now you're making me think.
No, sorry. We'll move on.
Most of it had to do with how could you? It was like, how could you support that sort of thing? And the thing that was difficult was they could never make the connection that Laos is not Vietnam, and the two were so you know, and I didn't really know how different they were because I hadn't lived in Vietnam at that point. But when you talked about the kinds of things that I'd done, they certainly didn't seem like war effort kinds. Well, they were war effort in retrospect, but they were humanitarian kinds of things for the most part. So I just felt very good about what I'd done, and so they were sort of hammering us on the idea that we weren't allowing the people of the of the region to make their self-determination kind of thing. We were the policymakers, and we had no right to be there. And so the operative way to deal with that at the time was to say, well, what about the headmen that they've killed, and what about the number of teachers that they've killed? And this is all hearsay, because all was based on Vietnamese history, recent history that you'd heard about, but you really weren't. Not a whole lot of folks got knocked off while I was around in Pak Se the year before, so there had been some, but some incursions up in the Bolivar, up high in the Bolivar Plateau. Not much, though.
Mm-hmm. And then when you left Berkeley, you went to Arlington for?
Language training.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And a little bit of area study stuff that the government gave you. Boy, that's really vague in my memory, though. I can't remember exactly what that amounted to.
Well, I have
to.
A list of 100 questions about the training in Arlington, but we'll pass over them.
Okay.
Since your memory seems to.
Yeah.
And then you found yourself back in Laos.
Right.
About what time again?
Would have been the first quarter of 66.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was assigned to Wapi Kham Thong province. Wapikhamphong. Is one of several spellings, I think.
Yeah.
That's close.
Uh-huh.
And there's another guy that was a FSI, or not FSI, FSO, a real Foreign Service officer that lived with me there.
Foreign Service officer as
well,
opposed to?
As somebody who worked for state as a career officer, a career Foreign Service officer, as opposed to an AID. Employee of state. His name was Peter Leiden, and he and I lived together until I went to Vietnam. We lived in a house there in Wapi Kham Thong.
And what did you do?
We did the typical community development officer type of things. We were counterparts. We were counterpart to the Chao Quang of Wapi Kham Thong, and
what would you spell that? It's just
C H A O K H O E U N G, I think it is.
And that person, there's a rank.
Yeah,
which indicates
that would be the governor,
uh-huh.
The governor of the province. And we worked with him to administer the full range of AID programs in the area. which included road building, which included well drilling, school building, and just everything that AID did was, to one degree or another, was being done in Wapi. Wapi was one of the less secure areas at the time.
Did you have any contact with forward area teams?
No. We went into, we, the closest I got to that sort of, well, no contact with teams, but across the river, there's a river, the Sedon River, I think it's the Sedon River, on the, would be on the west side of the river. I'd go over there to dispensaries, and that was sort of at nighttime, that was enemy territory, and in daytime it was pretty okay. And I got into those areas, but I never saw any forward area teams, as they were called. And I never ran across that sort of people. I wasn't plugged into the military real well, and I don't think Peter was either. Even though he was a sort of a different rank, and was, I don't know that he was there for a different purpose, but I think he was just like me in a sense. He'd gone through the same program I'd gone through.
And was there anything different early on in that work from what you were doing with IBS?
No. Now, the only difference was the contact with the Chao Coin. You didn't have that kind of contact when you were with the IBS, but there just wasn't a whole lot different. And I sensed that back in 19, when I, that's when I said earlier that why not just go to work for AID and do the same things that you're enjoying and get paid a little bit more, which is pretty much what drove me into the AID at that point.
And did you ever have any IBS people around or working on projects you had set up for?
Well, I used to go over to the same, there are still IBS people in Paxe, and I'd go over and see them in their house and in and around town. And I had a place near the compound, near the AID compound, and so I had my own house, and I used to invite them over. And so I still had quite a lot of contact with IBS. But I didn't have anybody assigned in my province that was an IBSer.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take that back. There was one guy, gosh. And there was one guy, that's right, for a short period of time, and we actually took our meals with the same Lao family. Well, I can't remember his name, though, Mark, I'm sorry.
Well, but remember it. Yeah. It'd be interesting, because then we can check how many lies that you've been telling.
Right.
try
not to tell many lies.
Did you know Howard Lewin, by the way? Was Howard there?
Yeah.
And well, we can talk about him later. It's mm-hmm. funny. I spent a lot of. He was the first person I interviewed.
I see.
And it turned out to be a really great first interview.
Right.
It was very interesting. And but anyway, he was rather. Could you describe any change in your perception of what you were doing or what was happening in Laos while you were there? When did you leave Laos for? That's probably a good question.
Yeah.
What year?
I was there for a very short time after I got back. It was, and I was brought over to Vietnam.
Okay.
So I might have been there. What month did I go to Vietnam? It was there. It definitely was in Vietnam in '67, and I just can't recall as to whether or not I transferred in '66, late '66, or it was in '67. I have a feeling.
Do you remember the flood?
Yeah, I was
the flood in Laos.
Yeah, I was there okay. for the flood.
Right, that helped. That helped yeah. place a bit.
Okay.
And but
But soon after I was in Vietnam.
Right. So, after the rainy season of '67, you were in Vietnam.
Yeah, I know that it's either the right. third or the fourth quarter of '66
right.
that I went over there. So.
So you weren't really there very long, that second.
No, I wasn't.
Get there.
I got there the first quarter, I believe, and I would have left by the fourth quarter or the first quarter of the following year. So
and it just seemed like you were doing the
yeah.
thing you did.
It was. It was frustrating because it was essentially a corrupt and not very energetic Chao Quang, and everything you needed to do had to go through him. There was an awful lot of what I don't know if you've run across this term, force account work, as opposed to self-help work. That's a dichotomy of the kind of work that we did there. Howard was the kind of guy that did a lot of force account work. In other words, he was a road guy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, well,
he,
roads.
they just give them equipment and give them, and we just do it for you. We just, bam, do it for you. Versus the self-help stuff that was what the kernel of wisdom from IVS, mm-hmm. which was get the people involved and it'll become theirs, and that sort of thing. So an awful lot of the work that we did in WAPI was force account work that was, which we paid for. We built, for instance, schools, and they just bring in the lumber and slap it up. We'd build the schoolhouse for them. Mm-hmm. Kind of went against my grain.
Because you'd always loved rural development.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. But you did see a lot of very, very fast progress if in fact sticks and mortar are our progress mm-hmm. back in those days. But the action was turning to Vietnam. I mean, it was definitely, Vietnam was where the action was. So I volunteered to go there, frankly. I wanted to be around where the real center of the activity was.
Why did you feel that? Can you think back of what energized you in that way?
I had a subterfuge reason to, you know, it was hard to get transferred, frankly. It was funny. So I said my brother was a military officer and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be over there near him I guess the subterfuge was that I needed to go so he didn't have to go because they wouldn't send, that's right, so they wouldn't send two brothers, and that turned out to be totally false because about 2 months after I got there, he was assigned from Germany to. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, I got him transferred up to where I was, and we lived together for about 6 months. So, and Adam, that's a whole different story. But
no, we'll get to it. Yeah, that's interesting. One of the things that may happen as a result of the tape is I have my students transcribe. And as an exercise, and I've been doing interviews with Vietnam veterans as part of that, because there's so many Vietnam veterans in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and the students are really, you know, kind of enlightened by it. But the problem is the combat experience, for example, or a tanker truck driver or something like that, it's a very narrow world because they're not policymakers. They're the nuts and bolts of American military operations.
Right.
And even if you ask them larger questions, they're only speaking from not from their experience of how these questions develop, for the most part. And I think these will be, I think, many more interesting because it involves getting involved in international work, what kind of choices you make in life,
sure,
and things like that. And I think they'll get something out of it that way, too. So I don't mind, even though we're not talking about IBS and LOMS,
mm-hmm.
there's also another thing is what kind of person was involved in IBS, and where did it lead them, and what did they do? So
right.
we spend as much time post-LOMS or post-Vietnam as we do.
Okay.
So you that explains the subterfuge as to how you got there,
yeah.
but not why you wanted to go there. Otherwise, other than, I know what you mean by where the action is, I know that feeling, but was there something, for example, you were getting bored of the work in Laos, or did you feel that
I didn't think, first of all, there was no need for two of us to be in WAPI, mm-hmm. even though I liked the guy a lot. So there wasn't enough work to do, true. WAPI was not on the beaten path. I'll show you where it is on a map mm-hmm. A little later, but it wasn't really even one of the nexus areas of Laos, and
so it was the backwater of the backwater. So
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, sort of unimportant in a sense, and then I just have always been one that's wanted to be where the action is, and Vietnam, generally speaking, was that at the time. Mm-hmm. So,
well, September of 1966, I mean, 66, 67 was
yeah.
The build-up had finally been complete. There were over 500,000 American troops in Vietnam.
Right. I went there at the height, not quite the height, but just, you know, it was coming up the,
nice.
High up the curve.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you stayed there for...
I left in 68.
When?
Actually, I left. I resigned and went back to Laos, mm-hmm. and worked for Frank Manley for mm-hmm. just for about four months or so. Like, and he was always a good buddy, and I had this entrepreneurial background myself, so we hit it off real well. And I was going to stick with him, but then my dad got sick, and I came home, and he asked me to stay home, and I did.
That's when that was
69, early 69 is when I started working for somebody else besides AID.
Yeah, I was afraid of this, but I've forgotten now that one of the people we interviewed also worked for Frank.
Pulcini,
June?
June,
yeah.
June.
Yeah.
Her husband Ron was
Ron,
was
right.
was working
right.
For Frank, also,
that's
right.
Awesome.
So I went back. I resigned. Went back to Laos. Spent just a few months there, and then came home.
Hey, well, let's just for the fun of it, let's talk about Vietnam. When you got there, what were you assigned to do?
I was immediately assigned to the Chu Hoi program.
Oh, okay. Stop 1 second. We'll get that. You can spell that, by the way.
C H I E U. H-O-I.
Just trying to get these years straight. That was the 60s. Okay. Anyway,
yep.
So you were assigned to the Chu
Hoi. Either late 66 or early 67.
And
yeah.
who is your direct superior in that program?
There's a guy. I was assigned to Quy Nhơn.
Okay.
And the guy in Quy Nhơn.
How could you spell it?
Q-U-I-N-H-O-N. Big province, biggest province. Well, Quy Nhơn is the city, and Binh Dinh is the province. Binhdinh, I think it is. And biggest province in Vietnam, and most activity with regard to defection. The Chu Hoi program was a psychological warfare kind of a program, which essentially a defection program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and I worked for a guy named Harry Wagner, as I remember, and he was an American assigned in Nha Trang, and his responsibility was about 12, 13 provinces in Tu Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only American in the program assigned at a provincial level. Everybody else was Filipino. And this province was felt to be so significant that they wanted an American in that province.
Why Filipino?
I think because of the counterinsurgent background that they had with the Hooks.
They were trying to make use of other flag force.
Right.
To work in that program.
In that program, right. And I think, both the experience plus the English-speaking ability, I think, if you look at it.